Hello and welcome to the Gambling Files podcast. I'm your only host today, John Bruford. I'm not joined by my co-host, Fintan Costello. So he's not here to say bigara or any similarly Irish things. Let's come to Fintan in a second. I'm sorry this is a late episode. I've just been super busy. And without Fintan here to nag me, I let my standards slip. And I'd like to say sorry. I mean, I'd like to say sorry, but I'm probably not going to. No, I am. I'm sorry. Fintan is in the Sahara, running across it. Not the whole thing, because that would be suicidal, I think, probably. But he is taking part in a very famous ultramarathon called the Marathon des Sables, which Fintan and I have both dismissed in the past as being a posh kid's race. And I'm not actually being critical of achieving it. I just mean I could never afford to even enter it. So I think it's fair to say, as I think I bring up later in the episode, that Fintan has probably spent his recent windfall entering that race. So Fintan, if you don't win, I'm not sure we can call it a success. But a solid investment. It is a very difficult race. It's a multi-stage ultramarathon. The longest stage is something, I think the longest stage might be 50 miles. I think there's an 80-odd K stage in there. And it's self-supported, so it's not like there are water stations along the way or cheering crowds or anything like that. He's not on his own. He's with, 800 other people. But I would think they'll be pretty spread out and it's going to be pretty hot. Yeah, it's going to be tough. But Fintan's actually going to be, he's going to be back, I think it's next week, and he's coming on the podcast as a guest as well as his co-hosting ability. So I hope he's going to give himself some really tough questions. But he's going to come and talk about the race on the podcast, hopefully. I mean, unless it's just too painful to talk about. Maybe it'll be, like you see in the movies. I was in there. I don't like to talk about it. Maybe that's how he'll be. Who knows? I've been thinking about some great business ideas while Fintan is away. I'm thinking about new gaming company names, things that people could rename themselves as. Now, obviously, I don't really want to get sued or even piss off anybody that might potentially want to sponsor the podcast at some point. So I'm not going to suggest what companies could use these names. These are just off the top of my head. And I thought, I could just go and park the domains for when somebody definitely wants them. So I've got Squid and Helicopter. I thought that might be quite a nice experiential reference, because helicopters go into the sky and squids, especially giant squids, live very, very deep in the sea. So experiential wise, it's high up and low down. Although giant squids obviously get eaten by sperm whales, which also come up, I think, later in the episode. I've got aubergine and lettuce. I think that's quite a catchy one. But after I registered that, I realized that it might not be any good for the US market. So you might have to also register eggplant and lettuce. I don't know why it's called eggplant, because it doesn't grow eggs. But I guess that's just one of life's mysteries. Jazz Mag and Squeaky Dog Toy. I think that just speaks for itself as a gaming company name. And my personal favorite, Games and Stuff. I think that really, really speaks for itself. On this episode, I just have the two guests, but both utterly excellent. Sharon Singleton joins us to talk about some of the completely bonkers things that have been going on in Asia and Australasia. We discuss a little bit of the dangers of allowing essentially gaming monopolies when it comes to regulating them. And the dangers for casinos of single streams of revenue. We discuss what's going on in Australia, what's going on in Saipan, and I think we throw a little bit of Macau in there as well. And then I'm joined by the fabulous Jennifer Bowman from IGT. And it's one of those conversations where I think we both have brains that are like the multi-ball feature in pinball. So I've got to be honest with you, it does go all over the place. But Jennifer's a fabulously engaging speaker, a wonderfully intelligent person, and was just an absolute joy as a guest. I'd like to work for her. So Jennifer, if you're hiring, I'm not even very expensive. So without Fintan here to mock, I guess it's on to the episode. I hope you enjoy it. And we move on to our first guest. I say our first guest, of course, it's just me today, and I haven't recorded the introduction yet, so I've got no idea what I just said, because I haven't said it yet. The paradoxical nature of recording stuff in a different order. We welcome returning guest, flying solo, which is a little strange. We're both flying solo, Sharon.
Oh, well, that is a bit unusual.
Asia Gaming Brief's managing editor, Sharon Singleton. Sharon, hello and welcome.
Hello, John. Thanks for having me again.
It's totally our pleasure because, totally my pleasure. I'll probably mock Fintan in the introduction as well. So if I repeat any of my mockery now, I'm sorry. It's just the nature of time travel. Okay. Fintan, it's not that he didn't want to be here, Sharon. It's that he is running in an ultramarathon called the Marathon des Sables, which bills itself as one of the world's toughest races. I've actually seen it credited as the world's toughest race. People who follow ultramarathons will almost certainly know that that's not true, because there are some unbelievably difficult races out there. For my money, Badwater is the one that scares the living piss out of me. But luckily, now that I have arthritis, I will never have to prove that I can do the Marathon des Sables. I just mock people like Fintan who can do it.
Good for him.
I've said many times over the years that it's a posh kid's race because it's actually very expensive to enter. So I don't think it's a coincidence that he just sold Bonus Finder and then entered Marathon des Sables, because that's how expensive it is. I think he's probably spunked all that money on this race.
Well, let's hope he hasn't. I mean, that does sound like a pretty big expenditure.
Well, yeah, but also I've got a tenner on him to win it. So, you know, I'm even poorer than I was.
He might lose a tenner.
Yeah, but it's all relative, isn't it?
It is.
It's a big tenner to me. So I haven't got a company to sell to make that bet, you know?
Well,
we're not all entrepreneurs. I've got a podcast I can sell, but nobody's buying.
No.
So, Sharon, we wanted to talk about Southern Hemisphere stuff. Well, not just Southern Hemisphere, sort of Southern Hemisphere slightly to the right, depending on where you're standing, of course. There's been some stuff going on that I thought it might be interesting to talk to you about. And I'd like to start with what's been going on with the Star Sydney, because that is quite interesting and a bit bonkers.
A lot bonkers, John. It is quite, you know, I've been following this trial on an almost daily basis. So for anybody who doesn't know, there's a trial an inquiry in New South Wales looking into Star Entertainment's suitability for its casino license in Sydney. And some of the allegations that have come out have just been absolutely jaw-dropping. I mean, just incredible, all related to its China VIP business, with some $900 million put on China Union Pay cards, mostly for gambling purposes. And as you probably know, John, Chinese aren't supposed to be gambling overseas, and they're certainly not supposed to be putting money on their China Union Pay cards.
Well, what's a China Union Pay card? What's that? Is that like a food stamps thing?
No, it's just like a MasterCard and a Visa, but it's the prime card in China, and they're very, very widely used. But Star was apparently trying to tell the Chinese central bank when they were asked — it wasn't the Chinese central bank who asked Star directly, it was National Australia Bank — when they asked Star about these massive payments, Star tried to tell them that these were for accommodation and expenses. I've stayed in some nice hotels, but really, not that nice.
That's genius. I mean, how could they possibly have been found out? Hercule Poirot must be involved.
Exactly. It was the Chinese Central Bank who ultimately started saying, excuse me, what are you doing? And, asked its partner bank in Australia, National Australia Bank, to look into it. But, I mean, even at the end of the day, it makes National Australia Bank sound like they, you know, were the good guys. There was also something come out of the trial that they pretty much knew what was going on as well. They just all sort of avoided asking the really detailed question, the straight on, is this for gambling, to which, you know, they could either say yes or no. They were asked other questions that managed to allow them to avoid the issue, really.
Brilliant. I mean, it's there's something inspiring when you see great management practices. And it certainly makes me want to change fields and get into banking.
Well, yes. I was just talking to somebody who said it's an unmitigated disaster for corporate governance in Australia. I mean, frankly, I've only just like scratched the surface of it there. I mean, there was one case as a Chinese property developer who actually is based in Australia. He put $11 million on his card in one day to gamble in the casino. Nobody raised any red flags. Nobody said anything. Nobody thought to say, don't you think you've spent enough today? No, he just put $11 million on his card.
I'm not an expert on anything much. I'm probably an expert on the early films of Sam Raimi. I think that they might have to at least look into their AML procedures and a little bit of KYC. I mean, if anybody out there listening knows anybody at the Star and you could point them this way, that would be my top tip.
I think so, but they were warned. They were warned. They had an independent audit into the company by KPMG, and that report was presented in 2018. And they very clearly were told, we think that you are at risk. Your practices are putting you at risk from money laundering. There were also pictures emerged from around that time, CCTV camera pictures of people coming in with backpacks and suitcases full of cash into the Sun City VIP room. Now, the Sun City VIP room wasn't supposed to be handling cash at all. It was supposed to be done through the casino, not through Sun City's room. But Sun City apparently quite happily being handed bags full of cash. And when the casino tried to say to them, chaps, this doesn't look very orthodox to us, apparently Sun City weren't very helpful and weren't able to elucidate them on what they were actually doing. So instead of anybody doing anything, they just went, okay, and carried on business as usual. When management were told about this report from KPMG, the CEO, who resigned on Monday, was reportedly quite angry and tried to push back against it. And was described by one of his colleagues in this inquiry of sulking. It's just amazing.
I'm just making notes for my Guide to Good Management, which will be available in all good bookshops. Sulking's with a K, isn't it? Yes. But it's raining shit in Australia. That's amazing, because we talked a while ago about It was the Crown license, wasn't
Crown,
it?
Crown, yes, yeah.
And, you know, one of the things that I often say to people who are critical of the gambling industry is that, you know, the gambling industry is one of the most tightly regulated industries of any kind, certainly of sort of retail and leisure in the world. And, you know, I'm not saying that makes it spotless, blah, blah, blah. But then you hear things like this and regulated and there's a point at which somebody is
taking. I don't know what to say, really. I mean,
no, I think you were hitting the nail on the head with the start of that sentence there.
I've been sort of digging into this a little bit, and somebody who knows the industry very well was telling me, as far as he's concerned, and I think he makes a very good point, is that the way it's set up in Australia is that the casinos are regulated on a state level, and they're all monopolies. More or less. So the Melbourne casino, which is run by Crown, is a monopoly in that state, as was the Star Sydney for many years before Crown got the permission to open its Barangaroo property, which isn't open yet because of all of these money laundering and unsuitability requirements. But the point is, if you've got a monopoly, you're too big to fail. You know, the government were like, oh, well, what do we do now? Because if we take the license away, that's hundreds of thousands of jobs in the state that are just going. So it sort of takes away their teeth, if you like.
Yeah, but you're either a regulator or you're not.
Yeah, I suppose so. But at the end of the day, like I said, I mean, Crown was found unsuitable in Western Australia, New South Wales, and Victoria. All three of them, it has been found unsuitable. One of them, the Victoria inquiry, the Royal Commission there, they urged the government to revoke the license. They said that the instances of the corporate culture ran too deep to be able to actually turn this around in any respectable time. They've lost the trust of the public. Just the whole litany of things against it. But the government basically turned around and gave them 2 years to get their acts together. So, yeah.
That's insane. The whole thing, it's insanity. But there's a point at which it's not having sloppy AML, it's not having sloppy KYC. It's almost having open arms and saying to anybody, you know what, lads, bring your money over.
Yeah.
I mean, and that's criminal, fundamentally.
It is. I mean, obviously, we've got to be a bit careful what we say here because
it's an ongoing investigation.
But it is an ongoing investigation, and it is extraordinary. It seems like they willfully misled, if you want, or just deceived regulators, banks, anybody who was there to regulate them. They just basically trod all over the rules, didn't do anything that they were obliged to do. And when they were sort of very mildly poked, they lied. I mean, the CEO, one of the reasons he's resigned was he told the markets in 2019, I believe it was, that they were no longer dealing with Sun City, the junket agent Sun City, which is the main sort of crux of these problems, that money laundering was going on through the casino, the VIP rooms in Sun City. And he hadn't ceased doing business with it at all. They just moved their lovely, shiny, high-profile VIP room to a back room somewhere, let them carry on business with no signage. They had like Sun City ashtrays and lighters and things like that, but their sort of their main signage that would have signaled them as the Sun City Group was taken down. But they carried on doing business regardless.
Genius! I'm again just making notes for my good management guide. Just for the record, though, just to protect ourselves legally, we should say allegedly after everything.
Allegedly after everything, yeah. All right then. Mm. Yeah, no, I'm not saying anything that hasn't come out in open testimony. So it should be, you know, it's quite clearly there for everybody to hear.
That's amazing, though. I mean, it's like you say, you're just scratching the surface. I mean, this is just, it's like a stick of rock that's made of poo.
Yes, which is a lovely image. Thank you, John. That'll live with me for the rest of the day, I'm sure.
I'm a giver. So a friend once told me that her, it was her stepmother at the time, she had painted her nails for so long and with such sort of ardor and was so into it and so passionate about it that if she didn't paint her toenails, she was physically in pain.
How odd.
And it stuck with me for decades. And I said to my friend quite recently, I have this horrible feeling that on my deathbed, that will be the last thing in my mind.
And you're suggesting that mine might be that stick of rock.
I'm saying it's possible. But, you know, on the plus side, at least you haven't got to eat it. I mean, I think most parents out there have accidentally tasted poo at some point.
Oh, dear.
How did we get onto this, Sharon? Are you some kind of pervert?
I don't know. Let's go back. Where should we go?
Speaking of money laundering, that takes us neatly into the second thing I want to talk to you about, which is in no way associated with money laundering at all.
Right.
Apparently, some people are interested in having some kind of gambling outlet on Saipan.
Yes, yes, this is true. It appears that there are a couple of US investors from New Jersey, that's all we know about it so far, that might be interested in entering Saipan. But, and there's a lot of ifs and buts about this one to start with, because as you know, Imperial Pacific, a Hong Kong listed company, has got the monopoly license for that particular island. At the moment, the license is suspended, and the Casino Commission and government will be meeting in May to decide whether or not they revoke that license. Obviously, this is something that IPI has been fighting quite hard, and it's not been revoked yet. So that's the first step that has to happen. And then the second step, I guess, is that the authorities decide what they want to do and whether or not they break up a monopoly, back to monopolies, you see, because they've been saying that they think that more competition would have been a good thing from the first place, rather than being reliant on this sole industry, which is this sole company, sorry, that's just become a white elephant. But that said, there's a lot of doubts about how viable the industry is on Saipan, really. I mean, the Imperial Pacific came in saying, you know, it wanted to spend vast amounts of cash on building this giant, shiny, white and gold building right in the center of town that was sort of completely out of keeping with anything else. And the reason being was they were hoping to tap into the Chinese VIP market. And that market, to all intents and purposes, at present, does not exist in its current form, in its former form, sorry. And we don't really know whether that's coming back.
Yeah, I was, while you were talking, I was thinking, you know, about Imperial Pacific and the grand plans that they had. Mm-hmm. And of course, they were essentially operating out of a shopping mall.
They were. Yes.
So that was like a temporary license kind of thing, wasn't it? While they were building this palace to gaming.
Exactly.
I'm not laughing about what Imperial Pacific doing. I was remembering something funny that happened to me when I was 5. but those grand plans, yeah, it just.
I mean, when they announced the grand plans, everybody said, well, you know, there's no way that the tourism industry or the local market here can support a project of that scale. It's just not, it's not going to be viable. And at first it looked very viable. You know, basically they were that little mall outlet that you were talking about. This was figures from Bloomberg that I'm citing here, but when they first started doing it, they were generating more GGR per table than the biggest casinos in Cotai, in Macau, that is, which is just astonishing, right?
So you'd love to have seen that shopping mall car park, wouldn't you? It must have just been Bentleys from one end to the other.
Exactly. And a lot of suitcases, apparently. A lot of suitcases.
I'm sure there are, and that's just people, they were probably stopping off at the casino on their way to their holidays.
Must have been, yeah. Must have been just doing that.
Allegedly. But,
so they used to basically monthly report their VIP role to the Hong Kong Stock Exchange, but, you know, that stopped about a year in, I suppose. And we don't really know much of what's going on with the company at all. They've not yet reported their annual report for last year. I can't remember when I saw any serious figures from them. The license has been suspended since April last year, I think, but the casino has been shut since April 2020, since the start of COVID.
Where will all those poor shoppers gamble? I think this highlights something really interesting as well. Not just the issues of having a monopoly, but also the issues of having what is essentially a single customer stream.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely right. I mean, that's a broader problem in Asia as a whole right now. I mean, you know, the travel restrictions following COVID are being lifted around the region. There's only really sort of Greater China, which is still shut down, completely shut down. But most of the others are opening up. But the trouble is that they're going to be opening up without the Chinese. Mm. And most of them were built of a size and a scale to cater for a market which in the short term is not going to be there and is very problematic in the longer term, because China has clamped down more and more over the last year or so on Chinese going overseas to gamble. So
that's so one of the interesting things about this, the Chinese going overseas to gamble and money leaving the country, right?
Yeah.
Now, when Chinese go to gamble in a foreign-owned casino, which they can do in multiple places in Cotai, in Macau.
Yeah.
If I were a license holder, should I be worried? Should I be worried in 10 years? Because surely at some point somebody's going to go, hey, lads, you know what? With this thing about not gambling abroad, I've seen another way that money leaves the country.
Yes. Is that an issue? Point. I mean, sometimes it does feel like the ostrich has got his head in the sand, because yes, we don't have the junket agents anymore in Macau, and they were the ones who were providing the credit. There is a way for the casinos to provide money directly, but they have no recourse on mainland China if those debts go pear-shaped. So it's a very risky strategy for them. Mm-hmm. And yes, it's you know, just how much gambling will China tolerate? They want Macau to be more well-diversified. They want Macau to diversify its economy, full stop. So they're looking at things like financial exchanges and medical tourism. But, you know, fact of the matter remains is that sort of 85% of government revenue is from its gaming industry. And there's just not really enough space to create a tourism industry that would create or attract the level of mass market players, the volumes that could replace that.
So, well, that was kind of going to be my next question, because like Macau, you know, for the huge figures that we see and all that, Macau is a very, very small spit of land.
It is a very small spit
of land. So we're talking about, like, with diversification, we're either talking about appropriating what's already there and changing usage, which, you know, Chinese government will do whatever it wants in that respect, or reclaiming more land from the sea and developing on that.
Yeah, they could do that. The other option is one that's seen as the longer term plan, is greater integration with the Greater Bay Area, and in particular Hengxin Island, which neighbours Macau, and that's being zoned as a sort of tourism and leisure destination that will allow for the cheaper hotels and the more sort of non-tourist attraction that would sort of collect that mass market on the border of Macau. But Macau itself, I mean, if you remember 2019, I think they had 40 million tourists through Macau, and it was creaking at the seams. It's just, you know, they really struggle to actually cope with that level of tourism.
Yeah, certainly just the travel infrastructure. You know, anybody that's been through the hilarious ferry port will know that it doesn't cope well with more than one boat at a time.
Or try to get a taxi when you get through, or...
Oh, God, yeah. Don't even get me started on that.
Exactly.
There's a lot of interesting stuff regarding Macau. I mean, it's fascinating, but that single stream comes with so many hazards that you kind of... I appreciate the desire to diversify. Yeah, you know, you look at Las Vegas and how that's changed in the last 30, 40 years. It's extraordinary, the shift.
Yes, yes.
But
it's a completely different market.
It really could not be more different. And I don't see how it's going to be possible to... Actually, do you know what? Something else just occurred to me. So Hong Kong was handed back to the Chinese government.
1997.
Yeah, I was going to say ages ago. and Macau was handed back to the Chinese government.
1999.
Yeah, in 99. What? Oh, did you say something, Sharon? sorry, I'm kidding. In 99, and there's just 2 years between the two, but with... I'm not sure, there is probably a correct term for this, but with the sort of Chinesification of Hong Kong, with the mainland exerting more influence over Hong Kong, there's been a lot of pushback. Is Macau, I don't know, a little more compliant, or has there been any pushback there? I mean, if it comes more in line with the places around it, which are all essentially very much mainland Chinese, is there likely to be any conflict there?
Well, Macau has often put itself forward as being the good guys, you know, not like those uppity people from Hong Kong who did really push back. I think part of the reason is because they are so heavily reliant on something that China doesn't really like very much. So it doesn't like it at all. So, you know, they've got a lot more to lose, really, than Hong Kong if they do push back. I think there is sort of underlying concerns with the Chinesification. And then they had recent elections where, you know, it's made very clear that you had to be a patriot to stand in the elections. So basically, if you didn't like Beijing's line, you couldn't stand. So, you know, Macau's election process and politics is a lot tamer than Hong Kong, for sure. There is a bit of concern about Macau being swallowed into the Greater China area, much as Hong Kong is. Yeah, I mean, basically, if you're a foreigner now, they're cutting down on the blue cards for non-residents, the working visas. If you're, you know, a foreign Westerner, the chances of you getting one of those to go and work in Macau now is extremely slim. So, yes, it is being sort of swallowed into China gradually.
I wonder what will come of that. I wonder if it's all going to kick off at some point.
It's a lot smaller than Hong Kong, though, if you think about it. I mean, there's only like 650,000 people in Macau. So
it's considerably less international as well.
Yes.
I think it's fair to say.
Considerably less international. And my feeling is it's a different kettle of fish. I think it would really take something major for anybody in Macau to really take to the streets and have any meaningful form of political protest. Just don't really see it, really.
No, I think that's very fair. Have you ever kept any fish in a kettle?
Look, I'm not going to tell you that. I'm going to have all the animal rights people bashing on my door within 5 minutes of ending the podcast.
Well, no, I presume it doesn't mean like a kettle that you boil water in.
I guess not, no. But no, I have
like a sort of cauldron style.
I've never kept fish, so.
It's just an odd little expression. I mean, a lot of expressions, yeah, you can trace them quite logically, but kettle of fish is like, I don't know what's going on with that one. If any listeners have an interest in etymology and can tell me that one, I would be most appreciative.
Okay.
Sharon, thank you so much for joining us again. As ever, it's been an education. And it's sometimes after we've spoken, you know, my mind is slightly boggled. My mind's completely boggled today. So thanks for that.
Thank you. Thank you for having me again. It's great to speak to you, John.
We move on to our second guest. Still no Fintan, still just me. Is he mad trusting me to do this on my own? Yes, he's probably got a bit of sunstroke because let's not forget, he's running through the fucking Sahara. Still, never mind. I'm joined by... Do you know what I haven't done? Oh, I'm a terrible person. I'm joined by Jennifer Bowman from IGT. Jennifer, hello.
Hi, how are you?
I'm all right, except I didn't ask what your official job title is.
It changes often. So currently, I'm the Senior Director of Marketing for EMEA and LAC for gaming.
Wow. I can see why
you... at IGT.
I see why you use the acronyms, because otherwise, like, your business card would be, you know, you'd have to print it on a ruler.
17 pages long to get all the way through Europe, Middle East, Africa, Latin America, Caribbean. Which division, seriously, which title, everything. My title does change quite often with each reorg. So I always have to say, well, currently.
Is that just because like nobody wants to work with you, so they keep shuffling you into other departments?
No, I'm so popular. They keep adding another one.
I actually have another
title that includes global marketing operations, but it just got to the point that it got silly of how many lines are on a business card. So I usually just say senior director of marketing at IGT for gaming.
You do sound like a very, and it, we have met in person, but yes. I just, because people will be just listening to this, you do sound like kind of, you know, you very often in the media, you see a certain type of American represented, and they're super optimistic and smiley and they laugh a lot.
Yes.
Now,
I definitely fit that stereotype right up until I say something super direct. And then people are a little bit shocked, or I'm very fluent in sarcasm. And so then they're a little bit shocked. But I think I'm the queen of optimism. I do believe that where there's a will, there's a way. And that comes through quite a bit in all of my communications and being able to make things work throughout whatever you're challenged with.
Well, I was going to ask, and you have actually just answered this, but I'm going to tell you the question I was going to go for anyway.
Go for it.
I was going to ask how that fits, because you've been based in London for quite a while. And like that's there's something so un-English about the sunny attitude.
Yes.
But then you said you do direct and you're fluent in sarcasm, and that just says, yeah, you probably fit right in.
Yeah, that's exactly it. I first moved from the States to Holland, and I was based in Amsterdam for 7 years. And I'll never forget, this guy pulled me aside and he said, I really need you to stop being so politically correct. I said, well, why? And he said, well, we just don't know if you're lying to us or not. And I was like, oh my gosh, no, absolutely not. Like, I was just trying to think of a polite way to say things. And he said, no, stop. Our culture is very direct. Just speak very directly and we can take it. And I was like, oh, that's great advice. And it actually served me really, really well through the years. And then moving to London in 2012, luckily I have a great sense of humor, and the Brits are definitely full of humor and fluent in sarcasm. So I've been able to navigate away, but not without challenges. You know, I would walk through different courtyards and be like, hello, good morning. And my friends were like, you have got to stop talking to strangers. Like, stop smiling. Don't look at them. Don't make eye contact on the tube. Just move about your day. So that, it was quite a learning curve.
Don't even get me started on that. Seriously, right? When I moved to London when I was 25.
Yeah.
So that's about 200 years ago. And I was with some friends that I knew from back home. I'm from a very small town in the middle of nowhere called Ludlow in Shropshire.
Right.
And I was with some friends from the Ludlow area. And we were just mooching about as you do. And one of them said to me, you've got to stop doing that. You're going to get stabbed. And I'm like, stop doing what? He said, you've got to stop, you know, making eye contact with people.
Oh, dear.
I said, but I haven't actually made eye contact with anybody because everybody else is looking at their shoes.
Right.
But what I found was, and this is really weird, this did, for some reason, this didn't apply to the group of people I was actually with, but I kept bumping into people from Ludlow in London. And like all the time. And the way that it kept happening was they would also be the only person in a crowd or on a street with their head up.
Looking around, making eye contact.
Yeah, seeing the top of people's. I'm just like, if I want to look at my shoes, I'll just stay at home and put my feet up. I would much rather walk around, make eye contact, and say hello to people. But then this was back at a time. This was a more innocent time when you could spot people that were completely fucking crazy because they would be talking to themselves. But now, of course, everybody's got those shitty little white frigging earphones. And you can't tell who's mad anymore because they might just be on a call.
They might actually just be having a chat.
Yeah.
I do think that's
fair. It used to be so easy.
I keep telling my partner I want to move to the Shires. I've decided I'm a Shire girl in the end. And I keep going to Shropshire all the time. And I was like, this is lovely. Look, there's the Severn River Valley. We can take the steam train. We can go to, you know, the Iron Bridge Museum. And I'm having all these grand moments between, you know, all the castles and the priories and everything that are out there. Now I'm running around like I'm, you know, an English heritage site guide instead of, you know, just finding something to do other than sit around looking at the television on the weekend. But it's hilarious because the one thing that I always tell people is I said, everybody's so friendly there. Like they all stop and have a chat. And I love it.
We do. We're mad for it. But there is a similar kind of directness to some of the countries there. But I'm amazed that you've been to Shropshire because even most people I know from the UK don't even know where Shropshire is. And Shropshire's fucking huge.
It's massive.
But it's like, you ask someone in the UK, be like, no, I don't know where that is. Is that near Manchester? Well, ish.
to be fair, I used to think anything outside the M4 was in the north. So,
but you know, what I used to find was like, you know, I travel down to London for events and this, that, and the other.
Of course.
And somebody would say like, oh, where have you traveled here from? I go Ludlow in Shropshire. You go, oh, yeah, how about that M25? And they talk about some stretch of the M25 in like the southeast of the M25. Like I should fucking know.
You're like, I'm sure the services are fantastic. Let me know.
No, I would just let them carry on with it. And when they'd finished, I'd go, hey, you know that cafe with the wagon wheel outside just by the turn into Bishop's Castle? And they go, no.
You're terrible.
Fuck. Which is just one of the reasons I'm so popular in the gambling industry.
That's hilarious. You have to keep a sense of humor about life and interactions of random people.
Apparently there are points at which you have to take things seriously, but I haven't really found any of those yet.
There's a few. It's always, well, I think that's the great thing about the gaming industry is when you're involved in something that's based on entertainment, you get to have a lot more fun at work than other people.
Well, as the great Rob Denham once said to me, he said, it's just like being a rock star, but without groupies.
Yes, that's my line. I'm going to call him. Say you're a rock star without the cash and groupies.
Oh yeah, that's a good shout. But you know, with Rob's background, he's probably got a couple of big patents sitting on there. He's probably
got the cash.
Probably spends the first couple of hours of the day counting his royalties.
He's one of my favorite people. That there's a, you know, a handful of us that literally chase each other around the globe and kind of go city to city, trade show to trade show, and you know, catch up as we're meeting. And they might live, you know, 30 minutes away from me, but you end up meeting in Macau at the show and then Sydney at the show and Las Vegas at the show. And we always have a really good laugh about it.
Well, Rob lives over my way now. I say over my way. He's probably about an hour away. He's just outside Gloucester, I think.
Yeah.
And he's, you know, he's caught the bug. He's caught the bug of living in the middle of friggin' nowhere. I'm a big fan. But yeah,
I think that made us all a fan of a green space, to be fair.
That's not why we're talking today, to be fair. Because I want to talk to you about a few things. One of the main things I wanted to talk to you about was women in gaming. And it's a good job Fintan's not here, because I think Fintan, in a terrible display of casual sexism, referred to it as chicks in gaming at some point.
Oh, wow.
And I just, I'm so embarrassed for him. But I did say to him, that'd be a great way to start a conversation with you, just to see if you'd just kill us both.
As a chicken gaming.
Yeah. So that chicks in gaming thing, how's that going?
How's that working out for you so far?
But no, women in gaming, it's become... Just, I don't know how to put it. It's become like I went to one of the events in Vegas probably 2.5 years ago, probably before G2E 2019, maybe.
Okay.
And it was a huge event. I mean, it was just absolutely packed. I was one of very few men there, so I was having an awesome time. Unfortunately, everybody was taller than me. So, I mean, I really have no idea who was there. But No, it was incredible. It was incredibly well attended, really beautifully put together as well. Mm-hmm. And it was just, it was an eye-opener to the, I guess, the sort of strength and depth of the organization, because I saw people from all levels there as well. And it was just, yeah, it was, I had a really nice time. Big fan.
I think that's the most remarkable thing that's happening across the industry in general. I mean, there's not just one organization that is advocating and creating a space and conversation for women in gaming. There's multiple. Some are very focused on the individual development goals. Some are very focused on what are we doing collectively as an industry. Others are more from a corporate perspective and why, you know, women in gaming and diversity matter. So, and that's what I find so wonderful, is that no matter where you're based in the world, there's a group of individuals that are saying collectively, we can provide a space and conversation and platform for people to reach their development goals and to help the industry start to recognize the contributions and greatness of all the individuals. And how do we take that even to one more level, right? Or three more levels, whatever the aspirational goals are. And I think that's exciting. And I think that our time in the industry is an exciting time to kind of grow. You know, I've been in the industry for 22 years. So I always say that I grew up gaming. And just, you know, the metamorphosis that my career has had and the opportunities that I've had, even just the geographies that I've been placed in, those are simply because of opportunities that I've recognized or someone has given me or helped me to find to be able to explore that. And I think that's what's happening with the huge explosion around diversity and inclusion and women in gaming networks and the power that that can bring an elevation to the entire industry by giving this space and this voice and a megaphone in some respects. And you're right. In the past couple of years, it's just, I wouldn't even say it's having a moment. I would say that this movement has taken hold and we're just seeing the works have more transparency and visibility and much more publicity at, across all levels. It's not just a top executive or entry-level program, or it's absolutely reaching the entire industry, whether it's sports betting or digital or casino gaming, et cetera. And it's exciting. It's exciting for me. I mean, it must have been exciting for you to kind of walk into the room and think, wow, this is a powerhouse of women from all over, right?
Yeah, it was amazing. I mean, it probably sounds facile the way that I'm describing it, but it was genuinely quite profound, because I was raised by my mum. Mm-hmm. And my dad was present. He was just fucking useless. And so I've always had this really, really strong female presence in my life. I mean, right, until a couple of years ago when she died. But most of my key relationships in my life are with women. Most of my close friends are women, and I have zero issues with developing relationships with women, yeah, on any level. And I struggle a little bit when I see blokes who can't do that, because I just don't get it. I don't, you know, you read these horror stories of people in interviews who have balked at the idea of having a female boss, and you think, well, what? What? Yes. I don't, yeah, get it. And that's really foreign to me, but it blows my mind a little bit that it's 2022 and we're still talking about gender pay gaps and stuff. Absolutely. You know, I mean, it's,
and fuck, we should have dealt fair, with that 30 years in my ago. Mind as well. It was quite a shock for me when I left the States and moved to Amsterdam to take on this role in our international division. And it was one of the male executives in the organization pulled me aside and said, wow, what's it like being a female boss with an all-male staff and you're American on top of that? And I mean, I was so shocked by the question, and they were genuinely asking, like, what is this experience like? But I had just kind of taken for granted that it wasn't an issue. And I was coming from a background of parody and from a family of matriarchs and things like this, that I was just kind of blown away by it. And then I started to pay a little bit more attention. And I started to watch recruitment patterns, not just in our company, but, you know, everywhere. And I started talking to people about what does it look like in, you know, if somebody decides to become a parent and that return to work, and is it part-time and how is that supported, or full-time? What does a management progression path look like? And it was such a process of discovery for me that literally I was just blown away, because although I was raised by these, you know, fearless women, and everything that they had fought towards, you know, to your point about, you know, pay equity and representation and equality, it never occurred to me that I would be facing it, or that the next generation would be facing it. So it was really quite shocking. And it kind of led me down this path of, well, how do you become an advocate for change? How do you provide opportunities for other women? How do you amplify voices that might be getting lost in the crowd and things like that? And I've been very fortunate that I've always had excellent relationships with mentors inside and outside of the industry, and people who have championed me and allowed me a great platform to share my ideas and give me the opportunity. So I think the more people that offer that to others, it just helps move this more towards where we should be in 2022. You know, a fantastic thing happened this couple of years, right? Where we're suddenly having these conversations at a whole new level than before. It's not a small little group that's talking about diversity and inclusion. It's massive corporations going through massive change, and cultures going through change of what's acceptable behavior, what's acceptable language, what's acceptable practices. And it's rare when we get to live through a period of history, and lucky for us in our generation, we're seeing it live in action right now in a few different accounts, and not even just on this, but it's also exciting, right?
Yeah. I mean, the potential for change at every level of organization, simply because of, I mean, a lot of people see diversity as box ticking, etc. They don't see how a genuine kind of social dynamic simply should exist in any microcosm anyway, just by the law of averages. Do you know what I mean? It's like there is no reason why most professions shouldn't have pretty much 50-50 representation in any space.
Yeah, it's interesting to me how it's kind of gone from a perception of an exercise that maybe, you know, an HR department might have at looking for recruitment practices and things like that, to now suddenly being a part of everyday conversation. And over, we see studies being issued where the more diverse your organization is, the more profitable your organization is, and how this diversity of thought and diversity of backgrounds and gender mixes and things like this can really transform your business results, right? It used to go from a people exercise to it changes the entire environment. It changes the entire culture. But not only that, it changes your financial results, right? And that's, I think, the paradigm shift that's happened recently that's been able to lend to so much momentum, is it's no longer the right thing to do only because of the actual representation of gender split in the world and communities, but it's the financially responsible thing to do to your shareholders as well, to provide a more diverse and more profitable workforce, right? And I think that's, for me, where I saw people suddenly embracing change in a whole new level, not only just from the humanitarian right way to act amongst each other and in communities that must be, you know, getting along together, but also actually in how do we capture differences to make us stronger? How do we capture the diversity, whether it's gender parity or things like that, to really propel this to a new level of excellence? For me personally, like, it's the favorite thing that I love about my job, because, you know, obviously I now actually am a dual national. I've got my UK citizenship and my USA citizenship. But my favorite thing about my career is I have the opportunity every single day to work across multiple nationalities from a geography standpoint, work across multicultural environments. I work with a ton of men in the industry, obviously, but I work in marketing now, which has, you know, a larger proportion of women. And it's interesting to me that every single day I'm confronted blatantly with cultural differences and different biases. And how do we navigate that together to be a stronger organization? How do I navigate that myself to be the best leader possible, to make sure that I'm giving opportunities and platforms to others to rise? And it's exciting to face each day knowing that I get to learn that day, again, something new. And that's the beauty of this industry. We were joking a little bit about how there's a group of us that are at every single trade show and event, world to world to world, that we never actually meet in our home countries. But it's also that experience that is so mind-blowing and opens up your eyes to this whole new world that helps with creative problem solving and the way that I approach my daily life. Does that make sense?
Yes. But your relentless optimism is grating against my British cynicism, I'm afraid.
I do genuinely see this as like the world of opportunity. And I think that's actually what keeps us going, you know, of hey, that, you know, whatever challenges you might be facing, there is this great opportunity to make yourself better. And make your company better and make your department better and make the industry better. The limelight on women in gaming that we have right now and the movement towards, you know, increasing and, you know, all the diversity and inclusion initiatives, it's making us such a stronger industry that's way more sustainable, way more resilient, and much more holistic to what we actually are providing to players, right?
I am not arguing. Just saying I'm cynical.
You're like, no, there's no argument, just interested.
when you were living in Holland, and I've asked Fintan this and he sort of undenied, but when you were living in the Netherlands, did you think that a lot of people sounded like Sean Connery?
I don't know. I think only Sean Connery can sound like Sean Connery. He's a pretty specific garble.
Yeah, but there's something about the Dutch accent. I mean, it's a beautiful accent and a fabulous country. But it's, I've met, you know, quite a few Dutch people who have that.
Yeah, it is a very specific accent when they're speaking English. I really, you know, hats off to anybody in the Netherlands. It's I've never seen a collective group of incredible linguists in my life. Like the ability to learn languages at fluent levels is, I've never seen it anywhere else in my travels. It's unsurpassed. It's incredible. But yeah,
the only place I've seen that's a little like that was I was in Egypt for a couple of weeks at one point, and I was just, it was quite, when I first got there, because, you know, I'm English, so I was basically like a beacon with the sun reflecting off my pale skin. People were just coming up, but they were, because of where I was, they were starting off in German, then trying Italian, then trying Spanish. then they might switch to Arabic, and then fifth would be English.
Incredible.
But the small children were doing the exact same thing. You know, I mean, it was really stunning. But after about a week, people stopped doing it. And I it was later explained to me, because I've got blue eyes and I tan big time when it comes. Apparently, I just looked Egyptian.
Oh, is it, you know, that's so funny that you mentioned that, because I was talking about something the other day and I said, oh, I can totally fit in. And they said, you never fit in. You stick out like a sore beacon. And I was like, isn't that an interesting concept of being, you know, in a foreign place, whether it's a foreign country or even just, you know, in an area that you wouldn't normally be in, you know, in a different company or a scenario that you wouldn't be in. That concept of fitting in and how people treat you differently if you stand out. You know, for example, you know, oh, you know, I'm super optimistic. I smile at everybody. Everybody has a different perception of me than somebody who might be, you know, very serious looking and and approach me from a different perspective. It's an interesting thought process around it of, you know, the importance of feeling like you fit in versus how you're treated, right? And it's actually, it kind of goes back to what we were talking about earlier around inclusivity. And, you know, we long often talk about the concept that, you know, diversity is being invited to the party, but inclusive is being asked to dance. And it's a similar thing when you're a foreigner in a different country where you can feel very much like a foreigner, out of your depth, very awkward, not really knowing how to fit in. And but as soon as you are taken by the hand and help to kind of immerse into a culture with an open mind, how that eases away and how you start to appreciate. And I don't know if it's necessarily the open-mindedness or if your behaviors change. But I do find that one of the most interesting things about travel, whether it's business travel or for leisure, if I'm just on holiday in, you know, foreign country, of where that goes.
Yeah, I remember, I mean, many years ago, a colleague described me as unmuggable. And I think because even if I'm in a foreign country, I just walk around like I own the place.
I think own your own space.
Probably, maybe I'm a remnant from the British Empire, and I feel like I do actually own everywhere. I don't think I'm a holdover from colonialism. I fucking hope not. I do have some questions.
Certainly.
How did you get involved with women in gaming? What was the path to that? I mean, how long has the group been together, sort of formally? How long have you been involved, and how did you become involved? And if you're gonna get onto mentoring, then I'm gonna have to bring some of my questions forward. But that's okay.
That's fine. I think it all starts with, you know, there's multiple organizations around women in gaming. You know, you were describing an event in Las Vegas. There's a great group in North America that's actually now global. And that's Global Gaming Women. They do a fantastic program of education and networking events, and it really focuses on the individual. So I'm involved in that. I'm involved in the I've acted as a sponsor. You know, IGT has acted as a sponsor of the Women in Gaming, which is now Women in Gaming Diversity Awards, through Clevel Deck Media, where we, you know, were approached for, hey, we think this is a space that we should be paying attention to. And we were happy to participate that and help provide the platform and visibility for the achievements of women in the industry that might not have been recognized in previous scenarios. So I really just started looking around at the different organizations that were there and understanding, you know, from a corporate perspective, at what level could we engage? And then obviously from my personal experience, you know, what level do I want to engage? So I'll serve as, you know, I'll serve as speakers on panels. I'll serve as judges for different events. I'll help people nominate, you know, colleagues or individuals that I think we need to shine a light on and provide a platform to show their achievements. You know, I think there's also, you know, other organizations like, you know, Lean In that is really looking more from like a corporate perspective and the industry perspective versus the individual development growth. And even within IGT, we have women inclusion networks that are important as well, where it gives people a small working group that's a support system and a good development opportunity for people to share their experiences and know there's resources available to continue the development. So it's not just one group. It's how did I get involved in speaking and providing a platform for others that I think they want to make sure that we know they have opportunity. There's so much opportunity in this industry, and the more we show a progression path and development path for women, the more we'll be able to build great talent and build skills of those that we have, and then recruit great talent into the industry as well. It's funny. This year I had the most incredible opportunity. It was actually serving on the United Nations Global Compact for Target Gender Equality Initiative in the UK chapter. And it was so powerful to meet with that group. And I serve as the IGT ambassador to that. the learning that you get from that, the tools that you get from that, you can carry forward across any organization. And then, of course, you know, to your point, one-on-one mentoring. But there were so many lessons of very quick, easy wins that I think organizations and individuals can benefit from. So to be part of that and contribute to that community and provide my voice and my network that I have to share that across, it was incredibly powerful and inspiring.
Well, that's nice. But
the nice part of the job to be able to talk about the really great things that we're doing as the industry, right?
But the thing is, and I do think this, there's obviously there are many commonalities between people, many commonalities between what you kind of think of as well, what we used to simply say difference between the genders back. Just, God, I don't know, 10 years or so ago when I'm pretty sure there were still only two. And I appreciate I'm sounding like a dinosaur in how I phrase that. I simply mean in how we express sentences like that. But I think a key difference between just looking at this in a binary way, between, say, women and men. Women, I might be completely wrong in this. I'm not 100% sure. I think women are more open to both mentoring and being mentored than many men are. Mind you, having said that, there's an awful lot of men that I know in the industry who have had a mentor figure. And those guys are very often, the guys that have been mentored are now at the top of their respective trees. You know, it's obvious that mentoring has a really profound effect and a really lasting effect. And it has an effect on how people then go on to manage themselves, how they go on to manage their own teams going forward. What's your experience of mentoring been? And do you like mentor anybody directly?
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's
I thought I killed you for a second there. I'm sorry.
No, not at all. I think it's really interesting because, the language has changed. We call it mentoring. We call it sponsorship. We call it championing. It used to be, oh, this is my protege, where you would find somebody who was a little bit greener in the organization and groom them towards a position of leadership that you wanted them ultimately to fulfill. And so I think mentoring has been around, but it's a little bit, it's a little bit more of a level playing field now. And I think it's a little bit more structured and commonly spoken about rather than just being a chosen individual to, kind of be the golden successor to whatever line of development. So for me personally, yeah, absolutely. I mentor a few people directly. I have a few mentors, both men and women, both in the industry as well as outside of the industry. I think it's really important to keep a very good objective perspective when you're looking at what does development look like so that you can kind of become your best self from a business perspective. And then when I'm mentoring people, it's both for men and women, as well as for people in marketing, outside of marketing, in the industry, outside of the industry. I think I probably get more learning out of it than maybe the mentee, because I get so much value from it when you're reminded of the basics of what you need to do in order to be successful, in order to be productive, in order to understand what does success look like and have that very honest conversation with yourself. But I think it's important. And I think it's past just that one-on-one relationship. The thing that I loved seeing over and over and over again around the New Year is I kept seeing this quote of, surround yourself with people that in a room full of opportunities, they would mention your name. And a mentor is somebody who can help guide you and coach you. But a sponsor and a champion, they're the ones who, when they either create an opportunity for you or will put you forward for an opportunity when it's arisen. And that's a power of a network that goes beyond only having a mentor. So I think there's, I think it's multifaceted now, and we've labeled it things that maybe previously we didn't in generations before. And I think it's much more equitable, and a lot of people just don't know how to go about it. And that's the power of finding somebody who does know how to network well and does know how to give you the right introduction or how to deliver a message that would be received in a more positive way than perhaps a different tactic.
Have you ever thought about going into politics?
When I was 19, I really wanted to be a political lobbyist for a living. I was like, I want to go be a political lobbyist.
I could totally see you doing that.
I think it'd be great fun.
I don't know if it would be fun, but I think you'd be very good at it.
I'm going to take that as a compliment.
No, it totally is. It totally is. Well, the thing hilarious. Is, I didn't send you any questions or anything before we started, so this is all off the cuff.
Absolutely.
And, you know, you're giving brilliant answers to everything, basically. And, like, you're finishing answering, and I'm just like, well, shit, I've got no further questions on that one. Well, one thing I'm curious about your take on, because I have a friend in the industry, and she often says about people, you know, quit your bitching and moaning, roll your sleeves up and work really, really hard. That's the only obstacle for women in this industry. Now, is there, because I mean, in the gambling industry, there are a lot of women in senior positions. I don't know that translates to a lot of women on the boards, but there's a lot of women in senior management roles for sure. Is there a glass ceiling within the industry? I mean, is there a point which we need to move beyond?
I don't think we're quite at gender equity yet. I think that there's been incredible progress, particularly in the digital space. We've seen huge advancements for women in gaming in the digital space, and how even just, you know, public statements of representation and equality in the numbers of employees and things like that are made much more so than we would have had in traditional business models previously. We also see geographic differences. You know, not every country has the same representation across it. So do I think that there's work to do? Absolutely. We've made huge amounts of progress, but I still think that there is an underrepresentation of groups of people at the board level, 100%, and in the very top senior leadership. Yes, we have more. We have a lot of great senior leaders as women in gaming, but I do think that it's not quite equal.
Do you think
we do have some work to do there?
Sorry, Jennifer. Do you think that the way forward with this is kind of a combination between sort of a change in, and you mentioned this earlier on in the things that you've been sort of looking into and exploring and using to better IGT and yourself. But do you think that the key changes need to be things like recruitment and following on from the recruitment, assuming that you spend the time and on the sharp end of that to get the right people into the organization, making sure that those people are developed, that they are invested in, not necessarily mentored as in a one-to-one thing, but invested in by the company in order to be kept by the company. Because the other thing that all businesses have seen post-pandemic to a greater extent than we've ever seen before is there's an awful lot of staff migration. And so, you know, investment in your team is a great way of keeping hold of people. But I've had managers in the past who haven't wanted to invest in me or in my team, because they're like, well, no, because if you learn how to do that, you're just going to leave.
Yeah, I think, you know, it's interesting. I was asked, you know, a few weeks ago about what can we do collectively to help keep women in gaming as a path, and how do we stop a talent attrition issue? And I think you mentioned, you know, the part about development, and that's a key part, right? And I genuinely love this industry. allows so much opportunity for anybody who really wants to learn. It's such an incredible industry, because if you show a genuine interest in something, and you do have to work hard if you want to get ahead. And that's regardless of ethnicity, race, and gender. If you want to, you know, you work smart and work hard and to be able to achieve your goals. But I genuinely think if there's somebody who comes to me and says, I really want to know more about marketing, I have done so many job shadowing days, or I've had people who work for me where I'm like, what do you ultimately want to achieve? They're like, I want to own my own business. I was like, okay, well, you're going to need to learn more than just marketing. We need to get you with procurement. We need to get you with finance. We need to get you with supply chain management, things like this. So you can see all the different aspects of it. And if you have someone who's super keen and you know that they're talented, I think that people will move mountains to give you the exposure to be able to develop you. Where we come into issues is if somebody has a different timeline than maybe what might be available in that organization. And as a people manager, it's my responsibility to be invested in my team's success, not just mine. You know, remove every barrier possible and help them see any opportunity that they can to help move their career forward. And yes, I've had people come to me and say, you know, please don't be upset. I have to resign. I'm getting my dream job. And I'm so excited for them that they were able to identify what they wanted and be able to clearly, concisely go after that and achieve that level of success. And I do think that the gaming industry towards women in general needs to show, look at how far people have come. I mean, I started out literally doing data entry in an unfinished warehouse part of an office in the corner, you know, making pennies on the hour. And I just kept asking more questions, and I kept making more friends and asking them more questions and finding out what else I could do, and raising my hand when a new project came up, and I knew it was going to be a lot of hours and hard work, but I also knew it was going to introduce me to so many more people and expose me to totally different departments. And I think we need to do more of that as well.
I think that's it. You know, once again, I have no argument there. I mean, it's, you've hit a lot of nails on a lot of heads there.
I tend to take one line and turn it into a story. Probably not great for your sound bites.
Well, no. You see, what I don't do with this is I don't edit it.
Oh, great!
This is going out in time. But do you know what? It's like as an editor. I believe that you spend the time finding the right people to do the job.
Yeah.
And then you let them express their voice, because a magazine is a platform for communication. It's not a platform for my fucking opinion. And so, you know, it means that the editing aspect of it is, you know, you're just making sure you don't get sued, because you want their unique voices in there. And it's the same with this.
It's the same.
We're here for your voice, not mine.
Yeah. And any organization, it's funny because every single person who works for me has a wildly different personality than me and then each other. And although we might institute a consistent process that people have to follow so that we can move things forward, the amount of creativity and diversity in thought that we get because everybody is so incredibly different than each other, it blows my mind every week. We'll be sitting in a campaign meeting and I'm just shocked at the perspective that people might have, and very different than something that I would have taken. And, you know, and then it's my challenge to provide the strategic oversight and the guidance and where we need to be from a perspective that you take that raw creativity and then how do we deliver on it? But it's also the joy, right? And it's what we get to draw on to make ourselves better, and how we allow to have some fun, right? Like this, we should be having fun every day. We're in the entertainment business, and it's important to me to really have a great day.
I have a very simple ethos. I have a very simple approach to life. I try and see or partake in something beautiful every day, Well, that might be as simple as seeing the sunset or the sunrise. But I just make sure that when I do that, I recognize it and I am present. And, you know, or it might be just doing something for another person. And not doing it in a, you know, look at what I did. I don't go and then tell somebody, look, I did this.
Yes.
You just do something for somebody and you're like, do you know what? They're going to go do something really fucking cool with that. And that is awesome. And one day they'll come back and tell me
that. Being completely present in the moment is incredibly powerful.
If I was an animal, I'd be a dog, I'm pretty sure. Not because I want to lick my own ass. Although, you know, I mean, everything has its benefits, right?
I think I would be a beluga whale.
Why a beluga whale?
Oh my heavens, they are brilliant. And they're just like so oddly beautiful in their own way. But they look super weird. And they are crazy intelligent. And they love people.
Do you know what a sperm whale looks like?
Well, now I'm going to have to go look one up. Yes.
Well, I've always thought that like a sperm whale, it's kind of like somebody said to, you know, say, for example, say if there is a God, I can almost guarantee you that God, if there is a God, has children and that one of his kids designed sperm whales. Because a sperm whale, an actual sperm whale, looks like a child's drawing of a whale.
Yes.
But do you know why they're called sperm whales?
Enlighten me.
Well, they were seriously prized, you know, pre-electricity and pre-gas kind of thing, because there is an oil which is in a reservoir in their brain pan. I forget what the oil does for them as animals, but it burns very cleanly and it takes a long time to burn. And so it was used in an awful lot of things back in the day, you know, like when whaling was out of Nantucket, et cetera, and the seas were full of sperm whales. This particular oil apparently looks just like sperm.
There is apparently the one new tidbit I've learned for the day.
Well, do you know what? If you ever get the chance to read the book In the Heart of the Sea, it's by a dude called Nathaniel Philbrick, who I don't know whether he still is, but he was the like the top man at the Nantucket Whaling Museum. And he wrote this book about, it's all about the events that led to, the events that inspired Herman Melville to write Moby Dick, because it was based on an actual incident. And of course, Melville was a whaler. But it's an incredible book and it's a really fantastic piece of, I almost said historical fiction because it does read like fiction, but he's used three different accounts for the crux of the story, combined with his incredible knowledge of the period and of whaling at the time. It's an absolute beauty. But anyway, sorry, I digressed a little bit there. That does happen in this podcast. Where are you from, Jennifer? Because I do detect an accent.
Yeah, I have a super thick American accent. I was born in Colorado. I was raised primarily on the Montana-Idaho border in a little tiny town of only 74 people. And then moved around that region quite a bit near Yellowstone. So the town is actually called Ledor, Idaho. And it's an old ghost town. And they used to literally mine lead and ore. And so they called it Ledor. And my grandma owned the pub, and it was great. We used to bus our school district in. It was about 25 miles in every direction in, so you could potentially have somebody that lived, you know, 48 miles away from you and was sitting next to you at school each day. But it was just this fantastic little microcosm of world where you learn about community and you were allowed to be your most incredible individual self because everybody knew you and so protected from everything. Now that led to separate challenges that, you know, when I would be traveling to see my father and he was always in a different city in different locations, that I had zero street smarts. So I had to learn a little bit about that first, you know, stop talking to strangers. I have zero stranger danger. But yeah, it was fantastic. We grew up in the wilderness. You had to know survival skills. You had to be independent. You had to know how to fix things when they broke. I mean, we had We had classes that we would cover everything from soldering to welding to agriculture to everything in between. Because if you were going to call an expert, you had to wait a few hours for them to arrive from the closest town. So it was a unique childhood. And growing up in the remote rural West, full of cattle ranches and that area, it was really interesting. But it's, you know, the mountains still call me when I need respite. That's where I go.
I hear you. But it's the thing that stood out for me in what you were just talking about is that you were near Jellystone National Park. Did you ever meet Yogi Bear?
I'm Yogi Bear's cousin.
Do you know what? That's hard to picture. I've got to be honest with you.
No, but I was actually really obsessed with him as a kid. I really thought he was the bee's knees.
Well, do you know what? It's my stepdaughter's birthday tomorrow, and she was obsessed with Scooby-Doo.
Oh, well, see, that's fair. I had Yogi Bear. She gets Scooby-Doo.
I think we've all had those sort of peculiar child, but she still loves Scooby-Doo. Do you still love Yogi?
I've moved on to Dory from Finding Nemo. I have a small Dory obsession.
Hmm. She's 26 tomorrow and she still loves Scooby-Doo.
She's my kind of people.
Well, you know what? I'm in a bit of trouble actually, because like when she was young, she had a boyfriend and that, and I said to her in front of her boyfriend, you know, no fooling around until you're 26.
She's
26. She's 26 tomorrow. She's been reminding me all week. She's like, oh, I'm gonna have sex
those
later.
The parenting moments that come back to haunt us.
Yeah, seriously. I should have said to her, I think you misheard. It's 36. But, you know, all credit to her for not getting up to any mischief.
Amazing.
What's really more amazing is that she actually lives with her boyfriend and he puts up with it. I mean, that's love. You like a bit of travel. What's your favorite place in the whole world?
Antarctica.
Why?
Did I say that really fast?
You did.
I am obsessed with Antarctica. I was privileged enough to go a few years ago. And it genuinely changed me as a human. It changed my perception of the world and how we interact with things, how we interact with animals and the environment. It changed my perception of the way that I wanted to live intentionally and be able to be more present in each moment instead of just looking forward to the next achievement or project that I was working on, things like that. And it's such a cool place. Like it's as close to leaving planet Earth and being on another planet without actually leaving Earth. It truly is otherworldly. So I can't wait to go back. It's the most beautiful, incredible place. But I actually want to go to the Arctic as well. And so people like me, apparently there's a term, it's called polar fever, where you just love, you know, being in polar locations. And so I'll do the Arctic next before I return to Antarctica. But if I ever have an opportunity to spend a year on the ice at one of the research stations, I would take it without even blinking. It's such an incredible place where every single moment you're wondering, you know, basic survival, and making sure that you're really paying attention to everything, because it's so precious there, and literally a case of survival. Like you have to pay attention to what's going on, or you know, it forces you to be very present in every moment of that life, and it's just stunningly beautiful. And amazing whales that you can see and seals. And don't get me started on my penguin obsession, the smelly little buggers. So it was an amazing trip.
I just assumed that you were going to say you're a big fan of the movie The Thing.
No. Just obsessed with Antarctica.
But so, I mean, I'm a little disappointed in your answer. But
can't you just say Italy?
I mean, it's a great movie. It's a good reason to like anywhere. I've got a thing about shape-shifting aliens. Well, you know, you're a senior marketing person at IGT, right?
Yes.
So the question that I think everybody in the gambling industry wants answering is, when is IGT going to change its name to something more experiential and catchy?
There seems to be a trend.
Really? I hadn't noticed. But did you have something in particular in mind? No, I can't ask you to. I'm not dissing any of your rivals at all. Another major gaming company in the space did change its name quite recently to Light and Wonder. Maybe this is an urban legend, I'm not sure. But they employed an agency called White and Lunder, and they came up with it. I don't know what their inspiration was. Jennifer, I'm shit out of questions. Is there anything that I should have asked you?
No, I love it when I leave somebody speechless.
You did it quite a lot.
I've had so much fun chatting with you today. Thank you.
Do you know what? I haven't asked you. Are you attending the Casino Awards?
I am. I will be there.
That's super. I'm excited.
It's going to be great. I'm actually really looking forward to that whole week and being able to see so many people in person that I haven't seen in a very long time and know that they're safe and be able to catch up with them. Nothing changes the energy and the love for an industry like a live event. Right? You just capture it all under one roof and it's tangible. So it's what motivates me to go forward the next day and be like, oh, I just had this awesome chat. And we're going to have so much fun because, you know, I just talked to so-and-so and they were so inspiring. Awards are always interesting to me because you get to really take a moment and celebrate what you got right and where the industry is really trending. And then you add to that the electricity of a live event, and it's all my favorite things in one.
I think one of the things that we wanted to do with the Casino Awards, and I've invited my publisher and co-organizer of the Casino Awards, Paul Ryrie, coming on this podcast next episode.
Great.
He's jibbed out of this episode because he's out on the lash. They're having their late Christmas do. It's pretty late. They should have just made it an early one for this year. But anyway.
It's spring break.
But yes, that's it. Spring break for publishing. And I'm here recording this. But the idea was to do something where we could also help the operators recognize their people. So we have some people-oriented awards, you know, people that have done exceptional things within their communities, that kind of thing.
I love that. Anytime we can provide an opportunity to show great examples in the industry, it's exciting.
No, but, you know, I was saying to you before we started recording that I had a previous podcast, The Bruford Files, which was about exceptional stories from people within the industry, and there were just shitloads of them. And it was that I ran out of motivation rather than anything else, because I hit a real trough because both my folks died in the summer of 2020.
And
I got to that and it's like, you know, I'd really like to carry on with this, but I really can't be asked right now. So it kind of died a death. But it was a tremendous experience and a real privilege just hearing people's stories. Because more often than not, when you're talking to somebody about an aspect of their, for want of a better way to put it, their real life, what you're really finding out about is the things that they're passionate about.
Mm.
And there is nothing more inspiring than hearing somebody speak about their own passion, even if you have no interest in it whatsoever.
It's contagious. And it helps. Yeah. It helps make a human connection that makes you feel part of a community.
But it's, I think, something that we sometimes forget as animals is what a pleasure it is sometimes to just be heard. It's a really simple pleasure, but it's a really, really important one. And
it's it's so true for me. You know, I recently won an award, and people were congratulating me, and they said, "Oh, how does this feel?" And I said, it's always a bit, I'm always a bit flabbergasted and kind of surprised by things, but it feels so wonderful to be seen. And if there's one thing that I can do for anybody else in the industry or in my organization, is to help them feel seen. Because it's such a motivating factor, and it's so powerful, and it helps connect people, you know, throughout their individual journeys.
Yeah. You speak a lot of sense, Jennifer Bowman.
Maybe you should tell my mom that.
Has anybody nicknamed you J-Bo?
I have a lot of people who call me J-Bo. I have quite a few nicknames out there.
Ooh, tell me some of your nicknames.
Let's see. We got J-Bo, Queenie. I go by my middle name, Helen, in some circles. I get all the normal ones. A lot of people, usually Brits, Italians, and Greeks call me Jenny. So I go by a lot of different things, but J-Bo, actually, there's two individuals in Reno, Nevada, who call me J-Bo, and about 20 in the London office who have picked up calling me J-Bo here. So maybe it's a UK thing.
I think it's very fair, but I might settle on something a little bit more from left field.
Oh, dear.
Something like... I probably need to think about this.
My sister calls me the Atlas. I don't think that's helpful, though.
I have thought of one, but it's a gesture, and unfortunately we're not doing video. So I'll show you when I see you at ICE or at the Casino Awards.
I look forward to it.
Listen, when you see me do it, it's not as rude as it looks. Give me a minute to explain before you punch me.
We don't want a repeat of the Oscars, do we?
Amazingly, we haven't brought the Oscars up yet.
Until now.
But seriously, right? There were two news stories that morning. So I was out delivering meat, not a euphemism. And the radio news comes on, so I turn it up. The lead story, Will Smith slaps Chris Rock at the Oscars. And I'm sitting there like, really? This is the most important story in the world right now. Okay, let's see what number two is then, shall we? And the second story was about peace talks in Turkey regarding Ukrainian prime minister, etc. And the story was, we may have to give up some chunks of our country in order to achieve peace. Now, when you put it in this black and white fashion, I don't think Will Smith slapping Chris Rock was quite as important as we may have been led to believe. I appreciate it may have been surprising and sensational, but important?
There's been some unbelievable news stories in the past 30 days that the more prevalence we can get to the ones that matter, I think are more important.
One of the problems with bad news, and especially with conflict, is that people can, I mean, with the best will in the world, can not become tired of them, but almost become fatigued by the relentless bad news. So I get it. I do get it. But you know what? Ukraine's been barely going on for any time at all.
Yeah, the whole industry is a bit shook. You know, obviously the whole world is shook up over Ukraine and the, you know, the crisis and the humanitarian crisis that's happening literally before our eyes. And for me, what's been powerful is the responses by individuals and corporations and things like that, more so than anything. You know, of course there's news cycle fatigue and having to only be able to absorb so much before you start kind of putting up, you know, defenses to protect your own emotional stability around it. But I was on a call this morning that was incredibly heartwarming when you start hearing about the unsung actions from people in how they're contributing and how they're volunteering, you know, during the night because they work during the day to help with refugee crises, those who have taken in, you know, refugees that we know in the industry and how they're opening up their hearts and homes. And there's something incredibly powerful to watch people have this human reaction to the humanitarian crisis that I think has changed me as a person in such a great positive way, even though it's so incredibly devastating from a news perspective. You know, what are my efforts? What are my dedication? What am I doing with my time and my money to be able to assist those in crises, right? And I think that's, you know, we've kind of talking in jest about it, but I do think that what the past 2 years have prepared us for collectively is really understanding where are the priorities that we want in our own personal lives. And what does that look like from a work perspective? What does that look like from a community perspective, from our level of health, safety, comfort levels with the pandemic? And then now, of course, we're all watching this crisis in Ukraine. And it's really profound to me what people are doing in reaction to it.
Yep, I hear you. And, you know, like speaking with my own kids and the questions that they have and their emotional response to just knowing it's going on is amazing. Because it is super easy to get cynical about things, like really cynical about things, and to forget that at the other end of an event is people just like us.
Yeah, the human factor, I think, is so prevalent. And because so much of our industry is affected by this, we're hearing it in daily work conversations over and over again as well,
yeah.
Which is fantastic. I love how much attention and how much efforts are going into doing anything we can to help people in the industry that might be displaced or suffering.
Yeah.
And I think it's a moment where we will all certainly remember and ask ourselves, you know, what could we have done differently or more and things like that. And I think it's important.
Yeah. Well, you know, I'm not arguing with Jennifer.
Once again.
We're singing from the same hymn sheet.
Yeah.
I would very much like to thank you for joining us. I've probably got, when I listen back to this, I'll probably think of about 50 questions that I should have asked. One thing I would like to just say, just like to ask for anybody listening that might want to know, how would people find out more about Women in Gaming and Diversity?
Yeah, so if anybody wants to reach out to me directly, of course, you can find me on all the normal social channels, LinkedIn, things like that, and I can put you connection directly so that you get the right information. But there's so many networks that are available out there on all the normal social channels. I mentioned just a few of them already, Lean In, the Women in Gaming and Diversity Award through Clever Duck Media and iGaming Post, things like that. There's also you know, Global Gaming Women, people can go directly onto their site and look for that. It's an excellent resource for people to join and become a member for that. So there's so many resources that are out there, including that there might be more local groups and organizations that we can help connect you with across my network as well. So if anybody wants to reach out to me directly, please do so. And I would love to connect you to the right individuals in the various communities to be able to help further the conversation and provide people access to these great platforms.
Thank you very much. I just thought you were going to say a URL or something, but
I'm way more inclusive than that.
That would have been entirely out of context with the rest of the conversation.
That would be way too concise for Jen Bowman.
Jennifer, thank you so much for joining us. If Fintan has any questions, it's tough shit, Fintan. You've missed your chance.
I really had a great time. Thank you for the invitation and hopefully somebody found it interesting.
As ever, if you enjoyed the episode, please find us on LinkedIn under The Gambling Files Podcast, on Twitter as whatever the hell we're called on Twitter, connect with myself and Fintan Costello. And you can subscribe to the podcast on the website, www.thegamblingfiles.com. We'd very much like to see you there, because it all just adds up to me hopefully being able to pay for my bike. And that's it, really. See you next time.